Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Forget stocks and the credit market for a second. It's time to focus on some of the keystones of the American economy. Things like housing and automobiles. Oh, wait, never mind. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Friday. It is the 17th of October as we round out another week in our coverage of the changing life of the global economy. Yes, the world stock markets have settled down, if only a little bit, but it does take more than just stocks to make an economy go, after all. We've got an update today on the U.S. housing sector, arguably the root of all economic evil lately. Most of us borrow money to buy our cars. We'll look at the credit markets in that industry. And on a related note, oil. You've seen how cheap it is, right? Yeah, not for long. Remember a couple of years ago, you could drive out to the urban edge of practically any major city in this country, and new housing developments would stretch as far as the eye could see. Those days are obviously gone. Numbers today from the Commerce Department prove it. New home construction has fallen to its lowest level since the 1991 recession. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
When you look at how much home construction has fallen since last year, the news is even more grim. Builders broke ground on one-third fewer houses than in September 2007. Since the end of the housing boom in 2006, the number's down by nearly two-thirds. Chris Mayer is a real estate professor at Columbia University. He says there's a pile-on effect.
We have mortgage rates that have been rising. We see unemployment rising and consumer spending falling. There's not really any good news in the economy, and it's hard to imagine people purchasing new houses or home builders even getting credit to start new houses.
But not all of America's suffering equally. Some housing markets are still chugging along, like Seattle, where Chaz Comstock lives. Comstock's a general contractor. He says houses, at least at the high end, are still being built in his area, and his renovation business is doing okay.
We are working steadily on a few jobs. You could say the shoe hasn't dropped yet, but by what we're hearing, that would lead you to believe that it is coming.
Comstock's already seeing signs of a slowdown. He advertised for construction workers recently.
And we were inundated with responses for a call out to lead carpenters. So there's guys out there looking for work.
Construction workers aren't the only ones who suffer as new home construction falls. Columbia's Chris Mayer says many people will feel the pain, from realtors to retailers who sell appliances and building supplies. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, that's real estate. What about cars? How does General Chrysler Motors strike you? There are reports today GM and Chrysler have stepped up their merger talks. GM is said to be short on cash and looking to cut costs. Just recently, its financing division, GMAC, announced it's going to tighten up on new loans that it issues. Toyota, on the other hand, doesn't appear to have any such qualms. This week, the company offered a new 0% financing program. So does that mean Toyota is somehow stronger than the rest in a flailing auto market? Ashley Miltite reports.
You could look at it that way. Michael Robinette is vice president of global vehicle forecasts for CSM Worldwide. He says Toyota can afford to grant 0% financing, while its rivals can't.
There's no doubt that Toyota has vast resources, greater than almost any other vehicle manufacturer in the world. It's in their best interest to make sure that they are able to use those resources.
He says Toyota is probably looking back to GM's successful post-9/11 sales campaign. It's hoping this effort will help it shift more vehicles. Which brings us to the bad news. Toyota's sales plunged 32% in September. Peter Brown is editorial director of Automotive News. He says Toyota's been growing for 15 years, so that downturn was a shock.
The parent company at home back in Tokyo, who's been making more than $10 billion every year, is suddenly having to do profit warnings. So they're in the same boat as everybody else.
He says Toyota's making the most of its U.S. competitors' problems.
They're running a big ad campaign going, we got plenty of dough. Don't worry about that. There's lots of dough. If you want to buy a Toyota, we can finance that baby, unlike a lot of other people. But at the same time, they're also giving away the money to try to keep the factories running.
Brown says demand for new vehicles won't pick up until the economy does. But he says Toyota's betting that anyone who's on the fence about a new car will take the bait of free credit. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Oil prices jumped a couple of bucks today, back up to almost $72 a barrel. Part of that was a sense that maybe yesterday's dip wasn't real. But the bigger bump by far came from whoever's in charge of scheduling OPEC meetings. The cartel is going to hold an emergency meeting next week, and the expectation is for a cut in production by the cartel. Sure, low oil prices are nice for us, but they're not necessarily good for OPEC countries. And if it's not good for them, it's not going to be good for us in the long run, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Oil prices aren't just on a roller coaster. Lately, prices are acting more like the giant drop at Six Flags. Yeah, it's been a fun ride, but we need to curb our enthusiasm about falling oil prices. Now, I'm not asking you to feel sorry for OPEC. Just listen to how very low, volatile prices play out. They're a nightmare for oil producers everywhere, deciding whether to invest in new oil fields. Bruce Bullock heads up Southern Methodist University's Energy Institute.
If you're looking at a major, let's say, offshore project, you're looking at 5 years before it probably produces a barrel of oil.
If OPEC countries don't invest in new fields, prices will skyrocket when demand increases. There won't be enough oil, and we'll still be dependent on OPEC because cheap oil discourages alternatives. Lou Polarisi is president of the Energy Policy Research Foundation.
Well, we go through another huge cycle of very low oil prices squeezing off investment, followed by very high oil prices bringing in more investment.
And low oil prices could lead to unrest in OPEC countries. Stephen Shork of the Shork Report says OPEC governments use oil money to subsidize staples.
The government simply isn't going to have enough money to keep fuel prices low, to keep grocery prices low.
OPEC countries can't risk unrest. That could threaten production. For us, it would mean higher prices. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Here's the only bit of market jargon you're going to hear in today's broadcast, I hope. Just a little something to keep you up to date on the credit markets. Something called the TED spread narrowed today. That's the difference between interest rates for 3-month Treasury bills and the 3-month LIBOR, that's a key European interest rate. When it narrows, as it did today, just a little bit, that's a promising sign for the unsticking of the credit markets. In the stock markets today, lots of movement, signifying not a whole lot. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. These are difficult times to be an investment banker. The big names in your chosen profession have either failed, turned themselves into regular old commercial banks, or been swallowed up by the competition. Just today, the Justice Department gave the green light to Bank of America's acquisition of Merrill Lynch. And worse, prosecutors are poking around. Subpoenas have been issued to an even dozen former executives at the Lehman Brothers. So there you have it. The kings of Wall Street are dead, which, if you ask me, sounds like a business opportunity. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The contrast could not have been more vivid. On the street, a victory parade, London saluting the Brits who won gold at the Olympics, while in an office nearby, somber reflections on an industry that has just met an inglorious end.
September the 21st, 2008, that's the date that's written on the tombstone of investment banking. That was the day investment banking died.
Professor of Finance Michael Minelli says on that day, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley applied to turn themselves into deposit-taking institutions. They were the last of the massive standalone investment banks that dominated markets in the last decade.
They are no more. This is the end. The question is, what will take their place?
The big investment banks failed for two fundamental reasons. They borrowed too heavily and they dealt too much in complex securities that proved impossible to value. Now they've morphed into commercial banks. They're going to get a lot more conservative, says John Moulton of private equity group Alchemy Partners.
I am sure that we'll end up with the investment banking activities within the likes of Citi becoming very, very restricted in what they do. And I think that'd be good.
He thinks the big investment banks will now be forced to refocus on their traditional business, organising takeovers and mergers, underwriting IPOs. They won't be allowed to borrow anything like the amounts they borrowed before. The regulators may not let them trade heavily in derivatives, nor get entangled with highly leveraged hedge funds.
Let those nice, exciting things take place outside with different stakeholders, people who are prepared to take the risk for the reward and can afford to do so without bringing our economies to the knees.
The humbling of the former titans of Wall Street seems to leave a gap in the market. So who will step in to fill that breach?
I believe that this is the most fantastic opportunity that I've experienced in my lifetime in building our business, and we expect to expand our staff and therefore our business as we go forward.
Ed Wedbush of Wedbush Morgan. The Los Angeles-based firm is a middle-tier investment bank with a net worth of around $250 million. Wedbush reckons that with Lehman Brothers gone and with Goldman, Merrill and the others at bay, he'll now pick up a lot more investment banking business, but don't look for explosive growth.
Our growth has been steady, and I believe at this point in time it'll continue to be steady, and there may be an occasional spurt here or there, but it's not going to be aggressive to the point that it disrupts our ability to perform.
Wedbush doesn't like high-octane products like derivatives. This doesn't sound like another Goldman Sachs in the making. In fact, says Professor Michael Minelli in London, it sounds more like the old British merchant bank model, the small teams of bankers who financed railways and canals and other projects in the 19th century. Most disappeared in the 1980s, gobbled up by big American institutions. Minelli thinks in the new financial landscape, the merchant bank could make a comeback.
Projects need energy, they need connections, they need commitment, and these small merchant banks are far more likely to bring that than some faceless bureaucracy of 40, 50, 60,000 spread around the globe.
Whatever form investment banking takes now, it seems likely to be lower key, on a smaller scale, and much less dangerous. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
I don't know if you'd call it calm exactly, but there doesn't seem to be the same existential angst about the economy this Friday as there was last week. To get a bead on what is going on out there, we've got Michael Mandel from Business Week with us and Jos Worso. He runs the Global Markets Division at Union Bank. Gentlemen, good to have you both with us. And Michael Mandel, I'd like to start with you to get your take on this proposition, that the immediate crisis has sort of passed and what we need to do now is just sit back and see what happens.
I wouldn't quite say that. What we've done is we've avoided a depression, but what we're heading into now can either be thought of as a recession or as a long transition of both the U.S. and global economies.
Transition to what?
Well, what we've had is a bunch of years where the global economy was driven by the U.S. consumer. The U.S. consumer was borrowing in the form of credit cards, in the form of mortgages, and most of the rest of the world was shipping to the U.S. And now that won't work anymore.
Jos Worso at Union Bank, what are the markets telling you about where we are?
Well, we started the week seeing some bright light in the tunnel here after a equity market boom on Monday, and then we got humbled in the following couple of days here. So I think the systemic risk is still there. There is some light in the tunnel, which is a good thing. The government has taken action. But let's get the systemic risk behind us, which I hope we can do over the next few months, and just focus on what effectively will be a reset of the economy. We're probably going to reset ourselves back a few years and then create a bottom and build from there.
Mike, is that your sense, a reset of this economy?
Well, reset is a word that makes it sound like we're going back to the way that we were before. I really think that we're going to end up with a very different sort of economy than we've seen for the last 8 to 10 years. You know, we've had this very bizarre economy where starting really about 2003, real wages started to drop, but people just kept spending. And we're just not going to see that anymore. And we don't know, and a whole set of institutions, a whole set of businesses built up around that consumer spending, those won't have a place in the new economy.
Yos, let me ask you this. You know, there's a school of thought that goes, we needed some kind of economic setback in this country, that we had just gotten so out of whack with the economic fundamentals that our spending has to be cut back and our credit use has to be limited. Do you buy that?
Yeah, I do buy that. I mean, my comment on reset is really the size of the economy. The growth we had the last few years in retrospect wasn't real. What we need to do here is we need to change our behavior. So we ended up being a place where we finance everything. Saving was something that we didn't think much about at any level, from the consumer level all the way up. Credit was too readily available. So the bottom line here is that we need a behavior change. And it's going to be a lot healthier once we change our behavior a little bit.
Mike, everybody's talking about a long recession. What is the starting point for this reset or rebalancing or whatever we want to call it? Is it end of next year? Is it the beginning of 2010?
Do you mean when does the economy start growing?
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying, yeah.
We may actually see growth next year, but it won't be sustained. It won't be the beginning of a long boom. We're going to bump along in a slow growth period. We may have some up years. We may have some down years. That's what I mean by a transition. It's not a just kind of return to where we were. It's a bumpy movement to somewhere else.
Yos, there's been a lot of talk, actually, about a change in the economic fundamentals and how capitalism as we know it really has changed. What might it look like as we get the new Congress and regulation and a new way forward on Wall Street?
Well, leverage is clearly a thing of the past, or at least the degree of leverage that we've seen in the last few years. Nobody really realized how levered everything was. We've seen the hedge funds humbled now, and we're going to have some more normal level of assets in these hedge funds. So I think as that deleverage has happened and continues to happen here, that's not a bad thing. That's a healthy thing. But this is where the behavior change comes in. People do have to save up that 20% for the down payment for the house. People do have to be more cautious, and that means financing becomes a much more normal and healthy addition to whatever you saved up. And that's what we have to see now.
Mike, same question to you. What's it going to look like, this brave new world we've got going out there?
We swung a long way to a less role for the government, and now we're going back to what is probably a more normal level of intervention, at least for a while. You know, historically, financial markets need the government to step in occasionally during crises, and so this is, in fact, part of capitalism.
Mike Mendel at Business Week, Yos Warsaw at Union Bank here in Los Angeles. Gentlemen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, changing the rules on poverty.
We are the richest country in the world, and there's no excuse for us having people in the circumstances that we do.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 1.4% today, about 127 points to close at 8,852. The NASDAQ fell a third of 1%, 6 points to finish at 1711. The S&P 500 traded down 0.3 as well, nearly 3 points. Ending the day at 943. For the week that was, the Dow rose 4.75%. The NASDAQ gained 4.1%. The S&P 500 gained 4.6%. Oil prices bubbled up on that news that OPEC could announce a production cut next week. That rallied energy companies. Chesapeake Energy gained 11.5%. XTO Energy lifted 7%. Valero rose 2.8%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.92%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Who can you trust? The banks? Our elected officials? Financial advisors? That question and more this weekend
on a special Marketplace Money show dedicated to America's financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Monday. If you're in California, Utah, Kansas, or Washington State, then it's the last day to register to vote in November's presidential election. The House Budget Committee holds a hearing on economic recovery, options, and challenges. And on this day in 1803, the Senate ratified the Louisiana Purchase. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Bush is set to meet at Camp David with French President Nicolas Sarkozy and the President of the European Commission tomorrow. On the agenda is the beginning of what could be a reshaping of the international financial system. The Europeans are pushing for a global summit on the issue in the next couple of weeks. Today, the White House said not so fast. There probably won't be a firm date for a worldwide get-together coming out of this weekend's meetings. Still, a well-known place in the history of international finance does keep popping up. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains.
In July of 1944, Bretton Woods, New Hampshire became the center of the financial world as delegates from 44 nations gathered to coordinate global monetary policy.
Invited by President Roosevelt to the first major world financial meeting since the London Conference of 1933, they will work in
the delegates at Bretton Woods created a system that pegged foreign exchange rates to the dollar. They also created the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Michael Bordo, an economist at Rutgers University, says the lesson for future global financial coordination is the U.S. has to be on board.
To the extent the Bretton Woods system worked, it worked because the Americans were behind it.
But it broke down in the 70s when U.S. needs trumped the desire in Washington for a global agreement. The U.S. still has concerns about losing control over its financial system. And even if the Bush administration were on board for a new global financial framework, it's unlikely a lame duck president could get anything done in the next 3 months. Still, says Sebastian Mallaby at the Council on Foreign Relations, worldwide financial reforms are needed and fast.
What's not so clear is whether these should take place on a multilateral level or whether, frankly, you know, national governments can do much of what needs to be done without complicated international coordination.
European leaders don't seem to agree. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says a lack of transparency and coordination is letting financial problems get out of control before they can be dealt with. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
We hear every day about people who are suffering in the economic crisis. Some have lost their savings, others have lost their jobs. But it's worth remembering that a lot of Americans had been forced out onto the breadlines long before the credit crunch. One big issue for the government is how to measure that poverty, how to establish where the poverty line is and therefore who ought to get help. There have been complaints for years that the federal formula isn't accurate and ought to be recalibrated. But some cities aren't waiting for Washington to fix it, as Rachel Dornhelm reports.
Hi, this is Miriam from the Helpline. Can I still refer a client to you for food pickup today?
Miriam Juarez runs the Helpline for a food bank in Alameda County. She's the sole breadwinner in a family of five. She makes enough money that up to now, she hasn't had to go to the food bank herself. But once she's paid the rent on her two-bedroom house, she finds she barely has enough for basic necessities.
Even 2 gallons of milk right now is like $6, and we have to ration our portions of milk.
Juarez finds it hard to make ends meet, but she doesn't even qualify for benefits like food stamps. She's not considered poor because she earns more than $24,800. That's the official poverty line for a family of five.
We're considered above the income, so I guess we would be considered that we would be okay, but in reality we're not.
The government first started calculating the poverty line back in the 60s. It drew the line based on the cost of food, on what a family needed to eat to survive.
Nobody thought that the measure adopted in the late 60s would still be used today.
Sheldon Danziger is a public policy professor at the University of Michigan. He says the poverty line has risen with inflation, but the way it's calculated, it ignores the reality of life for poor people. He says the calculation should factor in a host of things that American families need.
Food, clothing, shelter, utilities, and a little bit more. And the basket should be updated not for inflation, but by increased spending on those commodities by society at large.
For example, food has gone from a third of a family's costs in the 60s to an eighth today. Now, families spend more on things like rent and clothes. Public policymakers have talked about factoring adjustments like that into poverty calculations for years. Jim McDermott is a Democratic congressman from Washington State. Last Thursday, he introduced a bill to reform the federal poverty line.
My belief is that most people are serious about wanting to deal with people who are in poverty in this country. We are the richest country in the world, and there's no excuse for us having people in the circumstances that we do.
Many city administrations seem to feel the same. They're working on changing poverty calculations on their own. New York City recently raised the poverty line for a family of four to $26,000 from just over $20,000.
So it gives us the information that we need in order to shape policies that are relevant to today's world.
Linda Gibbs is deputy mayor of Health and Human Services in New York. Imagine a map in her office. Before the poverty line was recalculated, it showed clusters of poor people in neighborhoods throughout the city. After the adjustment, those clusters spread out, showing Gibbs where the city's poor really live. It's helping her direct benefits to poor people more effectively. For example, the city has managed to reduce the number of children living in poverty.
The flip side is we see higher rates of poverty among the elderly, mostly based on pharmaceutical out-of-pocket costs. And so that tells us something new.
Gibbs says Los Angeles, Chicago, and Miami are working on their own measures. But just because America's big cities are moving to change the definition of poverty doesn't mean the whole country will fall in line. Public policy experts like Danziger say wealthier states could agree easily on the federal measure, but states with a low cost of living might object for fear of losing federal aid. I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk, if it's hard to feel sorry for him, but he does have a good point. Earlier this week, tennis star Roger Federer topped the all-time career prize money list, $43.29 million. Turns out he's been keeping an eye on the credit crisis, too. Said it's a good thing he's got an extra large mattress. Not that he couldn't, like, buy a bank or something. Anyway, on this Friday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 127 points, 1.4%. The NASDAQ dropped 6 points, 1/3%. The S&P 500 lost nearly 3 points. That is 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy named J.J. Yore. Join us this weekend for a special broadcast of our personal finance program, Marketplace Money. Who can you trust in these economic times? And Monday on Marketplace, former Wall Street traders go looking for answers.
What would it be like if we had no regulation in meat and poultry? The market would not regulate itself. You would have garbage on your shelves. Why do they think it's going to be any different with banking?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.